Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and I'm going to keep this introduction short and sweet because we've got a long episode and a long vertical journey to make this week up the monument. Thanks to people who've been making contact to help us put together an episode all about the London taxi cab. Liam Laws, a special thanks to you. Some really excellent ideas there. Two notes about this week's episode. One, Mars bars are made mention of, but in the end, no Mars bar was injured in the making of this recording, which is why you'll find we don't talk about it at the end. And secondly, there's a buzzing noise that pervades certain sections of the show. I think I've worked out what it was. It was every time we were at the foot of the monument on the paving there. And for me, that is conclusive proof that there is something giant and electrical underneath the monument. I presume it's some sort of secret military complex, an enormous radar facility of some sort. Perhaps the monument itself is the pointy bit of a vast satellite dish. As you're about to hear, that wouldn't be entirely out of keeping with the spirit of its construction.
Hey baby, let me take you down, so we'll play some strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, sit out me, see me, see the air, land and sea. Some creep, some saw down the road, jam brand store.
My heart aches for some far off place.
Well, hello, hello. I got a very amusing email over the weekend. It was from a previous guest on the show, Secret London Runs, and they wrote to Londonist HQ, and they said, would anybody like to join in with a, was it a 10K or a 15K marathon that they're setting up? We'd particularly like to see N. Quentin Wolfe in a pair of shorts running along. And if you heard that show, you can probably imagine the brevity and succinctness of my reply. So on today's show, well, I'm looking up at one of the tallest flights of stairs in town, I would guess. It's the monument, and apparently I'm going to be climbing up it whilst eating a Mars bar. This is all very confusing. David Laird, hello.
Hello, nice to meet you. How are you doing?
Well, at the moment, I'm all right.
Ah, fantastic, fantastic. Well, I'm sure we'll be fine once we get to the top as well.
Are you?
We'll take it quite slowly, I think. Take it quite slowly, or I will be anyway, so.
I've come past this thing quite a few times. I don't think I've really appreciated it until the idea of climbing up it again, which I haven't done since I was a kid, was mooted. I don't think I realised quite how tall it is. How tall is it?
So you're looking at 202 feet of Portland stone to the top, or about 61 metres, 62 metres.
We are here, and I'm not sure whether to call it just an anniversary or a recognition or a commemoration.
Yeah, I think commemoration is definitely the right word. Of course, it's 350 years ago this year that the Great Fire of London took place, devastating the inner part of the city within the square mile. But we're also here to a degree to celebrate the structure of the monument coming into being. Not only was it here to commemorate the loss in the Great Fire, but also to celebrate the rebuilding of the city after that devastation.
Did this go up at the same time as the new St Paul's and all that stuff then?
So it probably went up a little bit earlier than St Paul's. I know St Paul's took about sort of 3 to 4 decades to complete and was towards the early part of the 18th century. The monument itself is actually, it wasn't constructed straight after the Great Fire, but its work starts in 1671, 6 years to complete, so it's a little bit before St Paul's, but it's definitely the same team behind Sir Christopher Wren and Robert Hooke.
And Of course, as we look around us, we're standing in a small courtyard, and surrounding us, of course, are modern buildings. And the taller of them, they probably go up about two-thirds, three-quarters of the height of the monument. So the built environment has crowded around the monument. Back then, this would have been visible from quite a long way off, presumably.
Absolutely. So what Hook and Wren were really trying to do with the design in the monument was to create a structure that could be seen at a great distance, but also that could be appreciated up close as that perpetual reminder to the Great Fire of London. So absolutely, it was intended to be seen from a distance. But at the same time, some of the buildings that surround the monument to this day do give you an idea of some of the heights that you would have seen in the structures within London in 1666.
Is that right? I think they seem enormous, far too big for the time, surely.
Well, what you find is you did have structures going up maybe sort of 7, 8, possibly even 9 feet. And in the summer of 1666, the big difference that you have is, of course, every building is made of wood. Part of the layout of the city, the buildings itself, they were actually built back on the same layout. And the difference being with the designs is you maybe had similar heights, but of course you don't have that jettying of wood at the top. That was one of the causes for the rapid spread of the fire back in 1666.
Well, that's interesting what you're saying about them being on the same footprint then, because I know for a lot of the cities, certainly some of the residential stuff, that wasn't the case at all. We lost a lot of those little alleyways, but you're saying around here it was better preserved?
Well, I mean, what you find with the Great Fire of London is, of course, almost 80% of the city is devastated, is completely flattened. Within the ruins, you actually have what was known as London Rocket, which was this very sort of unique flower that began to spring up out of the ground. But one of the big problems that Parliament, but also the civil administration found within the city, is that they had these layouts of the city, but there was no finance to actually redesign exactly how the city should look. So what you find is after 1667, when the Rebuilding Act of London comes in, we have a number of surveys are carried out. And this is really where we were introduced to the character of Hook. Land surveys are conducted so that people can rebuild on the land that was previously theirs. So what you find is whilst the streets stay the same, that difference in building style starts to pop up.
The use of stone after this great conflagration seems like too much of a coincidence. This was designed to be fireproof, right?
Absolutely. Now, I mean, in London, it's actually going back to maybe even the 14th century, they were trying to encourage the use of stone out of, well, exactly what happens with the Great Fire. But absolutely, so you're talking about needing stone structures so that the fire isn't going to spread in the same way. Yeah, absolutely.
I've heard, I'm not sure if it's a rumour, it might just be a fact, that the monument is not on the site where the fire started.
So yeah, definitely. When we talked about earlier about the height of the monument being 202 feet to the top, the story goes anyway that the monument, if you were to lie it down, it would actually reach the exact spot to where that character that every schoolchild knows from learning about the Great Fire, Thomas Farriner's Bakery, stood on Pudding Lane. Now, there's different stories as to why they didn't originally build on that site, and we know that the diarist John Evelyn was keen for the monument to be built on that exact site. One story that I've come across is that Farriner, after the Rebuilding Act, actually had his land survey conducted a few weeks before the surveyors went in to look at building the monument on that site. So Farriner beat them to it. So that's possibly one of the reasons as to why we didn't build on the exact same site.
Ah, you've just opened up a beautiful window into something that I don't know why I've never wondered about it before. So I know that the fellow who burnt down the Houses of Parliament suffered no real consequence at all, and I believe even stayed in his job, having set fire to one of the most important places in the country. Farriner was still a going concern then afterwards. He wasn't immediately lynched or put away.
Well, what you find is Farriner is not the individual who's really immediately blamed for the Great Fire. And really, what you find is that Farriner probably wasn't the problem with why the Great Fire spread so much. Of course, it's the cause, and we only have 6 fatalities, or recorded fatalities, in the Great Fire, one of which is an unfortunate maid that works in the bakery itself. But there's really 2 reasons as to why the Great Fire spread, and I like to think of it as a very British catastrophe, because what you find is it's the weather, and it is also, to a degree, an incompetent response from the authorities to actually stop the fire from spreading. We see the weather, and it was the wind, due to the direction of the wind pushing the fire through the city, but also the mayor of the day, the Lord Mayor of London, made a rather profane comment as to the fire's threat, and suggested that a lady could relieve herself to put the fire out. So he wasn't taking it particularly seriously, the spread of the fire.
This is while the fire's going.
This is while
well,
the
it
fire...
must be.
Absolutely. So Bloodworth, the mayor, is really taking no action at all. And it's not until a few days into the crisis, after Samuel Pepys forces the monarch's hand, or at least encourages the monarch to take action, that you find his brother, James the Duke of York, actually gets on board and mobilises the army to essentially start the firefighting. Bloodworth essentially raises the firefighting equivalent of a tickling stick and putting it out.
So what on earth are we talking about here? Is it the case that this laid-back attitude was a result of them going through this sort of thing quite often, and this one after a few days just happening to get even worse?
Yeah, I mean, you know, fire is something that had taken place before. One of the
but surely a fire going for several days in the heart of the city. Why were alarm bells not raised quite literally a little bit sooner?
Do you know, it's possibly one of the mysteries with the fire there, and I don't know the exact answer as to why that would be. To a large degree, it just appears to be the opinion of Bloodworth, and his response to it is just one of absolute denial.
Don't worry about it.
That's it, absolutely.
And how has he been, because his name wasn't familiar to me, how has he been remembered by history generally?
Well, I think he's ultimately remembered as the Lord Mayor who ran away from the Great Fire. And it's possibly, as we make our way round, and anybody who's walked past the monument notices that there's a list of names on the eastern side, and the list of names there are the Lord Mayors. Bloodworth's name is not on that list, and the Lord Mayors that you can actually see are those who were in office whilst the monument itself was being constructed. So he is not remembered as a Lord Mayor fondly associated with the monument, and certainly not with the story of the Great Fire.
Well, that's interesting. He's sort of been airbrushed out on some interesting level. Don't you feel like if the same events were to go down now, we would raise an enormous pointing finger, pointing at either Farriner or Bloodworth, and it would be much more personal?
You would think so. What you find after the Great Fire is there's the great tension within the City of London with the Catholic community of the day, and ultimately they are the ones that pay the price in those initial years after the fire takes place. I suppose with a lot of these things, it's always about looking for somebody to blame, and at the time, rather than blaming the establishment, it's politically appropriate to blame the enemy of the day in a way, which is seen as the Catholic community.
So that's the context. A word probably is useful about the object itself, because not everybody will have the luxury of walking past this on a regular basis. Could we have your sketch of the appearance of the thing?
Yeah, so anybody who has walked past the monument, or anybody who wants to appreciate the design, it's described as what's known as a Doric column, which means that it is a 20-sided column. It has a crown at the top, which is completed with the golden orb that you can see today. And a Doric column supposedly doesn't have a pedestal at the bottom, which we don't quite have with the design of the monument as it's separate. But again, we are going to talk a little bit about the base as we make our way round. Now, in terms of the actual design and construction of the monument, it was Robert Hooke and Christopher Wren, two incredibly famous characters in the rebuilding of the city. Now, Wren and Hooke had a wonderful partnership, and it seems to have been one that's viewed almost as a friendship in a way. Shortly after the Great Fire takes place, Hooke is appointed as one of the city surveyors, and indeed part of his role was actually looking after those land disputes to make sure that people weren't overstepping the mark in what was essentially their property to rebuild on. Wren is appointed as the general surveyor, so essentially the king's man in orchestrating the rebuilding of London. And you find that really over the next few decades, they go on to essentially rebuild a lot of that lost city. So during the Great Fire, you find we lose 85 churches, we lose the old medieval Cathedral of St. Paul's, and about 130,000 people are made homeless. Over the next few decades, you find that Hooke and Wren go on a mass rebuilding project. And one of the fantastic little quotes that I found is that Hooke is described as having, after the Great Fire of London, this catastrophe which hits the city, as one of the most productive and happiest times of his life. Now, in terms of the monument itself, there were three different designs in the original construction. The one that we are left with is one of the three. Originally, though, it was intended that it should be a tall column. And I will just say now, actually, this is still believed to be the tallest stone column in the world, freestanding column. One of the original designs was a phoenix at the top of the monument. So as London began to grow around the monument, you literally had the phoenix rising from the ashes. One of the slight alterations to that design was that flames would have been coming out of the original structure. One of the slightly more endearing stories, though, is of another design, which was largely what we have now, this tall stone structure. But instead of our urn having a 15-foot high statue of King Charles II. One of the reasons that they didn't go for that design in the end was, of course, the monument is here to remember the Great Fire of London. King Charles is the monarch at the time. Does he want, from a great distance and from close up, for his image to constantly be a reminder of the devastation that went through the city? So in the end, we've chosen and moved on to the urn. One of the other reasons as to why we used the urn, though, was that it opens at the top, and therefore the hidden use of the monument comes through, that of being a telescope.
Is this where we need to look a little bit more closely at Hook and his background?
I think so, absolutely.
There's a glint in your eye that tells me you're about to subject me to a staircase.
We're a few minutes away from
it. Oh, thank goodness, okay. I'm trying to mentally prepare
myself. Brace yourself, though. Yeah.
We're approaching the monument gingerly.
So we're slowly walking towards the monument, but just before we do, just on the piazza, so just as you stand outside of the monument, we have a plaque dedicated to Robert Hooke. So we've talked a little bit about Robert Hooke's role with regards to the monument, but anybody who's walking through the city and has a look at this plaque can see some of his other accreditations. So Hooke was the curator of experiments at the Royal Society. He was also seen as a key geologist, a physiologist, an architect, an astronomer, and even a natural philosopher as well. And this gives you a hint as to why Hooke and Rann were so keen to build the monument. And that is, essentially, anybody who walks past the structure is looking at a telescope.
It struck me that one of the crossovers, in terms of their characters, I know that Rann was very much a theoretician as well. Of course, he got his stuff made real. But he was very much about the ideas and the principles and the geometry behind how his work would work.
Yep. Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why you find that there's so many exact measurements actually in the monument itself. Again, kind of coming on to that, we talked about the monument being 202 feet tall and that story about it being the exact distance on its side from where the Great Fire started. But actually, coming back to Hooke being absolutely precise with his measurements, is this was the needed height to conduct not only his viewing of the stars. They wanted to use the telescope to be able to show the distance and changes of the stars in the night sky, and you needed that 202 feet. It was absolutely exact, and it was the same measurement that was used on earlier experiments by Hooke during the construction of St. Paul's Cathedral.
Okay, well, this makes me suspicious of whether the fire actually did start where they're claiming it started, because if you lay that monument on its side, it sort of overshoots the bottom of Pudding Lane by some distance, I'd say, doesn't it? Have you tried this out? Have you tried laying it down on its side?
Do you know, I've had a good go, but you need you probably need slightly bigger muscles than me. One thing I will say, though, is Pudding Lane has actually shifted ever so slightly as well. So there is a and we're talking a couple of inches here, so I'm not sure it quite helps the case in toppling over the monument, but Pudding Lane has ever so slightly shifted.
Which way? That's the crucial.
Oh, crumbs now.
Has it come this way?
Do you know, I'm going to guess and say it's gone slightly further to the east.
Conclusive evidence.
Bit of homework there for anybody.
Solved.
Yeah.
So are we heading up then?
I think what we'll do is we're going to quickly have
a
look.
Shall I stop giving you introductions to go up?
Yeah, but you're keen. That's what we like.
I'm not,
we like you to be.
Not remotely keen.
Keen to climb.
Fearful is what I
mean. We'll have one more stop and then
right.
We'll make our way up.
Around we go. What do you spend your time doing?
So my role, I work with the learning and community engagement team. So we are all about essentially facilitating schools, families and community visits at the monument. But we're also based over at Tower Bridge as well. So yeah, I mean, on a day-to-day basis, I tend to be taking school groups round who can age from the ages of, 6 or 7 all the way up to 60 or 70. It just depends.
I thought there was a certain avuncular characteristic in your delivery.
Possibly.
Round we come, we've got a big landscape inscription here on the side. I don't know if this is what we're here for, though, but it says the monument, and it's telling us about the history of the thing.
Do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put your eyes just slightly further up there, actually.
There can't be anything more interesting than the concessions rate.
We are kind of, well, do you know, and possibly the out-of-date concessions rate. But anyway, we're going to have a look up to the top, up to the frieze, which was put here by Caius Gabriel Cibber. But just before we do, actually, I wonder, when you're here, you notice the sound of the city coming through a little bit more. It's slightly noisy. And what you can hear is the traffic coming over London Bridge.
What we can hear is the enormous building site over the other side of the road there, where a lot of those shop units and the tall buildings above them are being turned into something else. Do you know what's going on over there?
You know, the only thing I know is that we had a lot of the city to rebuild after the Great Fire, and what you can probably hear is that they're still doing it to this day.
Just bringing it to completion.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, over the last 25 years, about 80% of the city has been rebuilt. So you're actually looking at, you know, sort of a different wave of it coming through. But what we're actually standing on at the moment, just on the west side of the monument, is the main approach to what would have been the north-south pass. We look straight down Fish Hill, where Fish Hill meets Monument Street towards the River Thames, and we can see the Church of St. Magnus the Martyr. Now, if we were to walk down that street in 1666, we actually would have walked straight onto Old London Bridge. So it just gives you another idea of exactly, as you walk up the street, just how central the monument was. You know, you would have passed it, and again, that symbolism wouldn't have been lost on you. But the symbols that we're actually going to look at here is the frieze of Caius Gabriel Cibber. Now, Cibber had worked very closely with Wren and Hook, more so Wren in a way, on a number of different projects. He was the son of a Danish cabinet maker, and unfortunately for Cibber, he was actually in jail at the time of the monument's construction, debtor's prison. But a couple of his more famous works, anybody who's taken the trip out to Hampton Court on the east front and noticed some of Cibber's work there, he was key to working on some of the inscriptions on the pedestaling above the top of St. Paul's Cathedral. But what he's depicting here in the monument is a frieze, which he was given one day out of debtor's prison to complete, or to at least start anyway. He was paid £600 for that one day, not enough to cover his debts, so at the end of the day he was put back into debtor's prison.
What could you possibly be talking about? One day to... Okay, just to give you an idea, listener, the piece here, we'll get exact measurements, sure, in just a moment, but I'd say it's about 15 foot by 15 foot. It's an incredibly detailed frieze we're seeing. Oh, what are we seeing? Okay, I think I can see some Armada-era soldiers going along there. We can see... I recognise that moustache. That looks like Charles II. He is holding a scroll. I guess this maybe refers to the rebuilding of the city, maybe their architectural plans, I don't know. Up top, we have a female regal figure and her cherubic attendant. I think that she probably represents a mythological character. Below us, coming out of one of the vents or drains or something like that, is a creature breathing fire. It looks like a Medusa-type character, maybe the evils of pestilence or of flame. This is an ornate, detailed work. This is a big work. One day? No.
Absolutely not. It did not take one day to complete. Cibber was here. Really, he had one day to be here for the work, but again, it took about a year to complete.
Well, what did he do in that day?
Well, do you know what? This is another
one. Did he just point to that and say to somebody else, put a frieze up there?
I believe what he did is conducting a lot of the original design, but no, it took a team of people to actually complete the work. I mean, you are talking years for its construction to be finalised.
Very beautiful, isn't it?
But just to put in a bit more context about that, I think your description is definitely going to beat mine. But essentially, what you're looking at here is King Charles II directing essentially the rebuilding of the City of London. So we've got a whole array of different characters, and anybody who walks past can pick a couple of them out. Actually, the first one that we're going to start off with is actually this lady who's looking slightly dishevelled in her garments. She's got her sword at a slightly awkward angle.
She's got lots of her at a slightly awkward angle.
She definitely does. She definitely does. And unfortunately for her, she's sitting under a mass of rubble, and we can see the dragon of the City of London below her. So this lady is actually representing the city. She's representing the city. It's fallen on its knees. You've got the ruins of the city below, and you've got that emblem in the dragon.
Which unusually, as opposed to its usual position, holding aloft a shield or welcoming people into an area, it's pretty much being trampled underfoot then.
Absolutely. It's been completely trampled down, and the city is looking dishevelled in this image. Now, just to put in a little bit of context with Charles II, everybody or a lot of people know about his famous mistress, Nell Gwynn. Now, supposedly, the design on the monument that Cibber has used, this was actually based on the character of Nell Gwynn, so the king's famous mistress there. Now, behind the City of London, we have a winged man with a beard, and he has his hands on the back of the female character of the city, and he's lifting her up. And this is essentially time. Time is lifting up the city. And one of the things that I find really endearing that I love about this image is behind time, you can see hands going up at the back, and these are the residents of London who are lifting up their hands in celebration to the city being reborn. If we swing over to the other side,
they're raising their hands up, and if you look at the building above them, we can see flames coming out of the windows above them. But on the other side of the frieze, there's similar sorts of windows, but surrounded by scaffolding and workers.
Absolutely. So what you're finding is on the left-hand side, it's all associated with the devastation of the city in those characters, but also the optimism of the city in that it's rising again and rebuilding. We've got the flames of the fire burning away, and again, 4 days that it burnt away until the 5th of September 1666. What you can see in the centre, high above, are these two characters representing peace, but also representing plenty as well.
Oh, that's the cornucopia, of course.
That's it, absolutely. Now, as we come over to the right-hand side, indeed, right at the back, we can see the workers beginning to rebuild the city, we can see the scaffolding, we can see the industry that's going into the structure itself being completed. But what you can see are these other characters. We have about six other characters, and in the centre of them, we, of course, have King Charles II. He's done up in a sort of Roman emperor. He's got an imperial feel about him. And what he is doing with his scroll is he's conducting the rebuilding of the city. And the different characters behind him, you can see just to his right-hand side, the other crown, this king, well, is the Duke of York, the future James II. Now, James, of course, is the one who conducts a lot of the relief during the Great Fire. But Charles is orchestrating not only James in the helping of the rebuilding, but those of liberty, of science and of industry as well, as the key components that are going to bring the city back to life. Under everybody's foot, you have this fire-breathing character, a little bit sort of Medusa-like in a way. This is Envy, and it is the king stamping out envy and the flourishing of the city once again.
That was a way better description than mine.
No, not at all.
If you have a look at the characters in the top right, these are the workers. And I don't know if these might have been crafted by a different pair of hands than did the three-dimensional images of Charles and his tribe there, but they're a little more two-dimensional. They're flatter, although they still protrude from the frieze itself, and you begin to see some of the characteristics of 17th, 18th century cartoonery.
Absolutely. This is one thing, coming back to sort of Cibber working on the design, you can, as you begin to look closely, see those slight differences and those slight different hands taking on the work itself. But yeah, absolutely, it definitely has that feel about it. So just as we make our way in, one last thing to point out is that the monument is a great way of navigating yourself about the city. If you're ever lost where you're heading towards, if you look just to the top of the pedestal, you can see that there are dragons. Now, there's four dragons on the monument, and the dragons, of course, representing the city of London. But one nice little thing to remember is that the dragons that are on the west side have their heads bowed ever so slightly, and that is out of respect facing west towards the monarch, whereas if you are on the east side facing in towards the city, they are raised just to make the differentiation between the royal and the civil. So anyone who's ever lost in the centre, it's always a good place to come and get your bearings by the monument.
Now, if you're drunk and trying to get home, it's a bad idea to walk along telling people that the dragons told you to come this way.
It's not bad. I mean, it's an idea anyway. You will notice that there are plenty of pubs around the monument as well, on each of the corners. So just in case you need the right way to go as you come out, it's always a good starting point. And that's certainly from experience as well. So there we go. But yeah, I think it's probably time that we made our way in.
Right, and we're going to do an experiment in the spirit of Hook.
So we've been talking about some of the different experiments that that take place here at the monument. We've got the barometer experiments, we've got the pressure experiments, pendulum experiments, even the telescope. The monument is actually believed to be London's oldest paying visitor attraction. And one of the things that we like to say to people is that, well, and it's absolute fact here, the monument is, well, we like to think of it as being London's oldest paying tourist attraction. Going right back to the days of Nicholas Olney, who was the original keeper of the monument when it opened. And one of the experiments that we like to conduct here is that it supposedly takes up to the top 311 steps.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And all the way down again, the same calorie intake as a Mars bar. So we're going to have ourselves a Mars bar as we make our way up the stairs.
If you come down via the steps.
If you come down via the steps. To be honest, your options are pretty limited unless you come down via the steps. But just while we wait for this queue to go down, actually, one of the great stories that's associated with the monument, and where it can get this ever so slight reputation as having a bit of an eccentric history, appeared in a publication. 1730, the Weekly Journal published a story about a nimble-footed man who supposedly was at the Baptist Head Tavern, which is actually a fair bit away over by the Old Bailey, and he was given 3 minutes as a bet to make his way to the top of the monument and back down again, and he managed to complete it 2.5 minutes and 2 seconds, running all the way down the stairs to the sound of "I'm coming, sir, I'm coming." Not quite sure that that's really what we need to gauge our own claim on the way back down.
Just wondering how you go about verifying that.
Well, again, it's the media, so you know we'll take every word that they say with a slight pinch of salt.
That's interesting what you said about there being a toll though from pretty much the get go. Does this thing make a profit?
It's always we welcome about 230,000 visitors to the monument each year. A profit is actually a good word for it, because originally it was actually seen as quite a lucrative position, being the keeper of the monument. And we know that Olney was put in position for about 21 years originally, and essentially the way that it worked is he had a certain amount of money that he had to give back to the city. I think it was around £50. Anything on top of that was pure profit, so it was actually seen as being quite for a canny businessman. It was a good opportunity, the monument, to make a bit of dosh.
It must still do all right then.
It still does. I mean, we're still incredibly popular. As I say, you know, we've got over 230,000 visitors a year, and it's for central London quite a well priced place to visit as well. For any Londoner though, it's a bit of a rite of passage coming to visit the monument. So
well. Are we going to bypass the queue, or are we elbowing our way past, or are we persuading our way past?
I think we'll persuade our way past.
Right.
We will shimmy past. We're quite tight on the way up, so we will we'll single file it, I think.
All right, we're going to do it. We're going to record on the way up. There are some electrics. You can probably hear a bit of buzzing in the background of the recording, listener. There are some electrics possibly running up the monument, I don't know, so we might be accompanied by a mosquito-like whine. Sorry about that.
It's all right. I will start the stopwatch as soon as we get through the door.
And what's the plan with the Mars bar, then? How do you want to do this?
I reckon what we can do...
I've got my hands full, so you're going to have to reach back and force-feed me at several step intervals.
It's absolutely fine, absolutely fine. I can do that. I have one in each hand. I think we'll eat it as we go up and see how we go.
After you. And so our journey begins. Are we nearly there yet?
So I reckon we're getting there. There may be some good spots for a break as we go up. So
oh, okay. Maybe... I'm trusting you on that. Thank you. Listener, if you are anything larger than a hobbit and you'd like a really exciting staircase experience, I urge you to go to the Clifton Suspension Bridge, and there are a couple of little spots down there through the cliffside where you can climb down incredibly small, almost potholes, through the top of the cliff and into the side of it to look out onto the gorge there. But don't rely on getting back out again. Well, I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
How far up are we?
I think we're getting there now. But
I can feel all of my leg muscles seizing up. You go on without me. Do we need to start eating the dogs?
Possibly. We could have a quick break if that would help.
I think we should.
Power through.
Oh, we're a long way up. I'm looking down the central spiral here. That's a great picture.
See, definitely the trick with climbing the monument is always look down and never look up at what's still got to come.
Well, you know what I'm going to do now then. Oh, what? Goodness me. Well, that's completely deceptive as well, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But I thought as we make our way up, actually, is a slight tale of tenacity. We've already talked about one with our nimble-footed man making his way up to the top. We've just come past Mandy, who's one of my colleagues, who is one of the keepers of the monument now, who looks after the monument on a day-to-day basis. Now, a story that took place in the early 1910s was of two suffragettes who actually occupied the monument. 10 o'clock in the morning, they managed to lock the attendant in the office, made their way up to the top. They then managed to throw propaganda leaflets off the side, and they unfurled a banner down to the bottom of the monument that read, "Death or Glory." And what's really nice about that story is not only did you have hundreds of men gathering to protest against this this demonstration of women's suffrage, but you also still see how the monument was still crucial in the thinking and the symbolism of the City of London at the day. Mm. But I'm losing my breath saying that story. Let's keep climbing up, I think.
It seems to me like Freud would have a field day there.
Absolutely, fantastic.
I'm going to peek out of one of the slit windows. I mean, they're designed to look like arrow slits, aren't they? And I suppose, at a push, they probably could serve adhesive defensive purpose.
Well, what you do find with them, especially with the earlier design, is you actually had these small slits where bronze flames were going to come out of. So I've always just wondered if they were maybe incorporated from the original design.
Huh.
But again, one of the great mysteries of the monument is that the original design doesn't exist. So it's part of the great debate over who built the thing. Was it Wren or was it Hooke? Did they work together? Who built how much of it? It's one of the great debates that we have, because that original design just does not exist.
What about the scientific instruments that you mentioned, or the scientific purpose that you mentioned, I should say? Did the instruments ever make it in?
How much more food?
Says a passing child. I couldn't agree more. This is well beyond the call of duty.
So
how much further have we got? Let's have a look. Oh, it's never ending.
Thank you. Definitely a few steps closer than we were 2 minutes ago. So we'll wait and see. But just a point on the instruments there. Rather than a lot of instruments actually being brought in, the monument is an instrument in itself. Right at the very base, which unfortunately is now our tourist trail, is an observatory. So if you look right down the centre of the staircase, all the way to the very bottom, there is actually an observatory down there. It's covered with a stone panel now, but this is the instrument itself, the construction itself. And as you look to the top, it would have been open to the elements, so you could see the stars and the alignment.
So what does the observatory look like? How big is it?
It's tiny, very, very small, very small.
Like a one-man type thing.
You're talking one-man. I mean, there were stories about the keeper actually living in there with his family, but you know, we've never been able to verify that, and it is an absolutely tiny, tiny space. But yeah, I mean, it is off the visitor route, but it is still visible.
We've been passed by people with much stronger legs than us. Let's have a look. I reckon we're about... Well, how is it possible that we've come up that far? I'm worried that we're going to run into the International Space Station if we keep going. The thing that makes it difficult to gauge is there being no corners to this staircase, so you can't look at how many floors you've got left.
That's it.
How many times have you done this mission?
Do you know, I think probably about 10 times in total.
And you've worked here for how long?
For about a year.
So this is once a month, not even?
I reckon once every 6 weeks is about good enough, I think.
I think this will do me for another 20 years. I'm sorry, Secret London Runs, I'm now officially crippled. Right. I need to start getting clever here. I think what I'm going to do is lasso my microphone cable around the next person passing me by who's going up and hitch a lift. We've got a log jam. Good afternoon. How long did it take you to recover once you got to the top?
Nanosecond.
No. Oh, okay. Good. Thank you. Yes, it's definitely getting narrower, which means that in order for people going up to go up, people coming down have to stop.
Squeeze past.
Thanks. I can see daylight. Here we go, we're at the top.
Okay, so we've made it.
Marvellous. We're on the roof of the city. Oh, goodness me. Beautiful.
Fantastic. It's definitely a view that's changed a lot over the years anyway. But yeah, we're now standing 311 stairs at the top. We've got another, well, we go up to 365 right to the very top, but we've just got this splendid panoramic view of London.
Would it be misleading if I were to say we can see Belfast from here?
No, absolutely not. And very well done through its camouflage there on the river, but not at all. I mean, it's incredible the view that we do get up here. You've got this lovely way that the old and the new really intermingle. Of course, in the distance, you've got Tower Bridge, which is built, 122 years ago. Just next to it, we can see City Hall. Of course, the HMS Belfast there on the river. Bringing it back to the Great Fire, though, of course, is that we actually can see almost the full spread of the fire from our position up here on the top of the monument.
Oh, yes.
So what we're seeing is over to the east, we can see where the Tower of London stands. Now, during that rather fateful summer of 1666, that was where the ammunition store was of the city. So in order to prevent the spread of the fire going towards, and, well, you can imagine what it'd be like if it hit the Tower of London, that is marking the point of where our fire breaks are. And looking just towards the Tower of London from this side, we can actually see this green-topped church, which is All Hallows by the Tower, and famously where Samuel Pepys climbed to the top as the fire began to rage.
Oh, yes.
Possibly before or after he buried his cheese, but it's from that spot that he describes it as one of the most miserable sights that he's seen. But as we make our way round,
So what are we saying about the spread of the fire, though? Is that the fire went up to there or went past
there? That's it. So it makes its way almost as close as towards the tower, but that's where the fire breaks and we're brought in, so that the fire never actually damages the tower. So that's us looking over to the east. As we sort of swing our eyes to look towards the river, and we can actually look straight on St. Magnus the Martyr Church. Now, there was actually a fire break already on London Bridge, and it's for that reason you find that the fire doesn't actually spread south of the river. But as we make our way round as well, we can start to see the very tops of the Old Bailey over in the distance, which marks Pie Corner. And anybody who's been up that way will have seen the Golden Boy of Pie Corner, exactly where the fire finished and it spread over to the west.
Can you point me at the Old Bailey?
The Old Bailey is... There's the Old Bailey. So we can see...
There's a lot of construction in the area.
Do you know what? I think we might be slightly dwarfed by cranes at the moment for the Old Bailey, but we're essentially looking just behind St. Paul's. May even be over just to where these red cranes are standing, just at the side there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, essentially you've got this great snapshot of the London that Wren and Hook actually constructed themselves, and of course, taking centre stage is St. Paul's Cathedral, completed in the early 18th century.
To say it's changed in character would be an understatement, but from up here, the sense that you get, actually in the west of London, in the West End of Georgian London, is almost entirely absent, I'd say. Maybe some of the, like we were talking about, the footprint of the street plan, and one or two of the near two buildings, but for the most part it is new construction.
Absolutely, and again, just as we said, in the last 25 years, it's an incredible amount of building work that's actually gone on in the City of London. You can actually look, though, as we make our way over to the other side, we're actually looking down on Fish Street Hill. So we can see sort of just how narrow, I mean, this was the main approach through the city, but you're talking maybe only about 10 feet across for that street. We will be able to see as we make our way around Pudding Lane, and the fact that it still retains that original street size. So even though you have the new, it is coming up through on the same grids as the old city would have been.
Well, let's head around. Excuse us, thank you. The viewing platform railing here has been bent out of shape so that we can pass by, presumably. It's a very, very narrow spot. Before they had this artful idea, you could only have gone by in single file.
Absolutely. I mean, again, one thing, you always got to be careful when you're up here in terms of getting too close to the edge. Unfortunately, one of the stories that's been associated with the monument over the years is the fact that more people have died falling off it than actually perished in the Great Fire, recordedly perished in the Great Fire itself, and it is for that reason that you have the mesh.
How much should I ask? I mean, it's a dodgy question, given that we're standing in the exact spot, but how many people have made this their last foothold?
Unfortunately, six. Six have made this their final spot. But on a slightly cheerier note, about 200 years, well, almost exactly 200 years ago, in 1814, there was a story came up of a local fishmonger who brought his pony to the top of the monument. So supposedly as a bit of a publicity stunt, he brought the pony to the base.
Presumably by carrying him. There's no way the pony's getting up the staircase.
The pony marched up every single step. It then marched around the gallery and all the way back down to the bottom.
No.
At a trot,
no.
Not falling over once. Absolutely, absolutely. What are they?
Hook would not approve of that as a scientific piece of information.
Do you know what? I think he would have appreciated the slightly eccentric attitude towards it anyway. But
what were his experiments aiming to achieve? What was he all about?
So, I mean, ultimately, the main one was using it as the Zenith telescope. You know, that's the purpose of it being built.
And what would the Zenith telescope have told us?
So hopefully? That would have told us the sort of the position of the stars in the night sky, but also changes in the night sky, and also just clarify the fact that the world is round. The stars come back round again. Unfortunately, the problem that Hooke and Wren run into is the fact that London is a busy place, and even by 17th century standards, there's a lot of traffic underneath, and the vibrations caused by the street made their... Essentially, they couldn't keep the conditions the same. They couldn't keep those exact measurements we chatted about before exact, and for that reason, as a Zenith telescope, it falls pretty dormant pretty quickly. But those other experiments, the uses of barometers to see how pressure changes at different heights, and again, you've got the perfect instrument in the staircase there, and another one was pendulum. He essentially had sort of giant pendulums that he would use on the staircase just to, again, I suppose, motion experiments.
Was this regarded as... I know it's the tallest and still is. Was it regarded as a feat of its time?
Do you know... I'm trying to think of the exact answer for that in a way, really. I mean, the Great Fire is often compared to sort of the fall of Carthage or the fall of Troy. And you have those sort of iconic columns in those cities. I mean, you have sort of Trajan's column over in Rome. And it, to an extent, was possibly compared with that by contemporaries. But I think it almost sort of stands on its own, really. Literally, the monument in a way.
We've got the walkie-talkie. And we can see the cheese grater and various other large objects. What is that over there? I'm pointing at what looks like one end of a cathedral. Two identical, very tall columns, comparable in height to what we're on at the moment. And in between them...
Here?
Yeah.
There, I believe that is St. Edward's Church.
Where would that be?
So that would be on... Where are we? So we're Fish Street Hill... I'm trying to think, is that Cornhill possibly over there? Because we have St. Michael's and we have St. Edward's, I believe. So both Wren's handiwork, though, so you can see sort of the similarities as you kind of look round as well. But it could be a bit of homework, that one. I'm not entirely sure.
Yes. One of the things I love as a sightseer in London, I think it's the Hungerford Footbridge. They've got a panorama with all the buildings marked off. And one of those up here would go down a storm, I'd have thought.
Do you know what it would do? I mean, one of the great things is you've got that iconic London structures that you can see. And I believe you can even see Big Ben from up here as well. But as you can see with the immediate vicinity, is that the buildings are slowly beginning to build up around us. Again, a lot of people know about that protected view of St. Paul's Cathedral. You know, in the certain points of the city, you have to be able to see it. Sadly, to an extent, the monument's almost kind of lost its prominent position over the years. And we just worry that eventually it's actually going to become kind of completely swamped by these new structures. So I don't know, a viewing guide would be nice, but how long that view will survive? We don't know.
Well, it gets simpler and simpler as the years go by, presumably.
That's it. You know, as long as they build some nice buildings, they'll have something for people to look at.
I think what you're going to have to do eventually, because, for example, the Oxo Tower is suffering from the same problem, I think what you're going to have to do is team up and put one on top of the other and regain height superiority.
I think so. Well, it sounds like a challenge anyway. It's a challenge for the architects anyway. Make Hooke and Wren proud, you know?
Well, I suppose we should start our descent.
Yeah, do you know, there's one last little tale, actually, just before we go down, is we're on the monument to the Great Fire of London, to give it the full title, but not a lot of people know this as HMS Monument.
No.
And then just to really take you back, is during the monument's had a lot of different uses over its time. It's here to commemorate, it's here to celebrate, but I mean, there's been a lot of other uses for the monument. It was actually built, this platform, so that it could be used to set off fireworks. And we know that this happened on a number of occasions, especially for the laying of the foundation of one of the new London bridges that went in the 1830s. It's also been used as an aviary. There was an eagle that was kept up here for a time. Sport and fitness, you know, this is still part of people's daily routine, getting up to the top and down again. But I say HMS Monument.
So you've got regular joggers coming up?
There's a few people, yeah. A few people work for the City of London do on occasion. Well, I say on occasion, some are quite regular, do make this their ascent to the top and down again. Good for the fitness anyway. But one more story just before we go down is that the building or the structure has had a sort of a use by the military in the two world wars. It's been used for signals, and we know that in the First World War they actually renamed it the HMS Monument. So it was taken over by the Navy for that purpose. Second World War, the monument was actually closed to visitors, and there is, if you ever see, there's a fantastic image of the monument during the Blitz. The whole of the city around Fish Street Hill and on Monument Street is absolutely devastated, but the monument is still almost immaculate in the centre. And once again, really the last time that London is devastated by fire, you've got Charles II in the middle of that frieze once again conducting the rebuilding. But yeah, so it was close to the public during the Second World War, and it was used again as a spotting point for sort of approaching enemy aircraft, essentially.
Well, I feel that time has come.
Absolutely. It's been happening.
We will tie off when we get to the bottom safely, and we can talk about Mars bars.
Absolutely. We'll see. We'll try and get down safely first to see how we go.
Yeah, I don't like your lack of confidence there. that it's a given.
So there is a quick way down and there is a long way down. We'll take the long way, I think. Yeah.
In respect to that, there's very strong reinforced mesh keeping us good and safe.
And just really sort of joking aside, in a way, when we talk about there is two ways down, there has been a story on several occasions of, a little bit like the bet that happened earlier on, of people actually using a rope to make their way down to the bottom. There was a story that popped
on
up.
On the outside or the inside?
Very much on the outside, but I believe the rope has gone, so we'll take the stairs.
Well, here we go. Now, I'm relieved to say that there's a couple more steps here and a closed-off area. This would presumably double not only as access to the very top, but also a useful cupboard to keep your mop, because the last thing you'd want if you came up to clean the platform is to get to the top and realise you'd forgotten that.
That's it, absolutely. You always want to remember your keys when you're opening up and closing.
Has that ever actually happened to you?
Never to me.
I'm just going to look down the tunnel that's formed by the spiral staircase. Well, goodness me, that is terrifying, actually. I'm finding myself transfixed by it. And you can see people's bodies poking out at various points down as they ascend or descend. Well, there are shadows at the bottom. We can't make out the people.
It's worth actually just while you're sort of mesmerised as you look down, and you just get a feeling of how exact the staircase is and exact those measurements are. You can imagine right in the distance at the bottom, just seeing sort of the glint in Hooker Wren's eye. But also, just as you look right to the top, you can see the covering.
Yes.
Where at one point you would have been able to look out onto the stars. You just get a sense of that telescope that you're standing in.
Marvellous. Okay, we've done it. And I've lived to tell the tale. I believe I'm still alive. And I've been handed a stiff piece of card. It says, this is to certify that Lion has climbed the 311 steps of the monument. And you're saying this is something that's been going on for a while, this certification?
Absolutely. I mean, it's been going on for years. This is your rite of passage to say that you've officially climbed and survived your 311 steps to the top and the bottom.
It doesn't say survived, and I'd really like that emphasised in the document.
I think so. But, the certificate, the pride in place there, I think.
Yes. Well, that's completely deceptive. I don't know how that works, but from the outside it looks like a stub of a thing compared to the enormous distance that you can see from the top to the bottom on the inside.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, really, so the final word is Daniel Defoe described it as a candle.
I'd really like to see it used for fireworks.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while since it has anyway, but again, that's what it was originally constructed for, so it hopefully can still serve the purpose at some point.
And if there's any sense of irony going on in the world, then one of the fireworks would go astray, catch light to something.
Do you know, I cannot possibly comment as a City of London employee.
Oh, yeah, of course, yes.
Couldn't say a word on that, I'm afraid.
I mean, it's normally at this point in the podcast, we'd say something like, for people who want to know more. But I think if people can't manage to find that out for themselves, then they're doing something wrong, really, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, what I would say was that this being our 350th year, 350 years since the Great Fire, is that throughout the city there is a whole programme of activities going on. So people do want to know more about the Great Fire. We have a number of different activities taking place here at the Monument, which is all on the Monument website and through Visit London as well. So I would definitely encourage people to check out what's going on in this summer.
And what is going on?
So, well, I mean, here at the Monument, we have a trail, which is our Great Fire, the Monument Great Fire Trail, which takes about 2 hours to complete, though you do have until September to complete it, which takes you on a treasure hunt right across the city of London.
Oh, not just up the Monument?
Not just up the Monument, no, but it takes the Monument as your starting point.
Right.
We also have a series of free talks that are taking place on Thursday and Wednesday lunchtimes, 12 till 2 o'clock, on the hour and on the half hour, and they're taking place just out here on the piazza. So if anybody wants to know a little bit more about the area that we've been discovering, yeah, they're taking place from now right up until the Great Fire weekend.
Magnificent. Can we finish with somebody who knows about the fire, a nugget of information that perhaps people won't have encountered quite so frequently, if at all?
Oh, wow. Let me have a think about that, actually. Supposedly, when the bakery burned down, the biscuits that were being made in the bakery were for the Navy. So I don't know if that's an interesting fact to
hold on,
but it's definitely something that is sort of believed to be true anyway. That they were being made for the Navy or made for sailors of some description anyway. Sort of in the hours leading up to the fire consuming the bakery and then most of the city of London.
David Laird, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to David Laird. Thanks too to Esther Saunders Deutsch and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Sounds you ain't never seen the light before. Just a stone's throw from your front door.